Okay, thank you for showing up, everybody. Chanukah Sameach. I am pleased that you are joining. This is our last class in this series. We have been through most of the Old City, and now this is our second class that we're doing outside the Old City. Last time we did Leaving the City, Neighborhoods Beyond the Walls. This time we are going to be talking about Har HaZeitim, the Mount of Olives, which is within the boundaries of Jerusalem today, but always was, as we're going to see, outside the boundaries of Yerushalayim, really up until very recently, but very, very much connected to Jerusalem. So we have this really nice view here of the mountain, right, of Har HaZeitim from Nachal Kidron at the bottom, going up to the top of the hill. Over here on the right, you can see the cemetery, right? We're going to talk about the Jewish cemetery. Har HaZeitim, one of those many places, particularly in Yerushalayim, that are holy to everybody, because why should we have different places when we can all share, right? So Har HaZeitim, very, very significant for Christians, and that's why you have a whole lot of churches. You can see some, as we see in this picture, right? The Church of All Nations over here, Mary Magdalene, the Russian Church over here, Dominus Flevit, Franciscan Catholic Church over here, churches on the top. Very important in terms of the events of Jesus's life and his soul ascending to heaven. Important for Muslims, right? Because they see this as the place that you're going to have the judgment of the last days. So somehow, sometimes we, in all these other religions, we forget that Har HaZeitim was originally very important for the Jews. The Jews are the first ones who are there. And we have so many connections between Beit HaMikdash and many other things to Har HaZeitim. It's not only about the cemetery, although of course the cemetery is very important as well. So we are really going to be exploring mostly the Jewish connection to Har HaZeitim. And let's get started. Okay, so let's understand where we are, first of all, always useful, right? So here's our old city that we've been exploring all along. To the east of the old city, to the east of Har HaBayit, you have this deep valley, the Kidron Valley, right? We keep talking about our valleys around the city. So the Kidron Valley, between the Temple Mount, right, and the hill of Ir David. And on the other side to the east is Har HaZeitim. Okay, so we are to the east of the city. We're going to talk about this, one of the names of Har HaZeitim. Har HaZeitim has a few names: Har HaZeitim, Har HaMishcha, which basically means the mountain of olive oil, mountain of olives, the mountain of olive oil. But it's also called in Tanakh, Har Asher Bikedem La'ir, the mountain that is to the east of the city, right? That's its definition. It's the mountain to the east of the city. The other thing that's important to understand is that Har HaZeitim kind of straddles the divide between the city, right? The city, green, civilized, etc. And out here to the east, the desert, okay? Midbar Yehuda, we often think of the desert, oh, the desert is far away from Jerusalem. No, no, no. The desert is on the edge of Jerusalem. Jerusalem really is, in essence, almost a desert. We make it green, but it really is on the edge of the desert. And if you're on top of Har HaZeitim, right, if you look to the west, you have the beautiful views of the old city. But if you look to the east, you have incredible view of Midbar Yehuda, of the desert. And we're going to talk about the Seir La'azazel coming from Har HaBayit, across Nachal Kidron, across Har HaZeitim, and going out to the desert. Right, so the desert really is very close and important to understand. Okay, the other thing we're going to talk about in the beginning here is that Nachal Kidron is essentially the border of the city. This is the where you get to the bottom of Nachal Kidron. This is where there's the sign that says, "Thank you for visiting Jerusalem. You are now leaving," whatever you want to say, right? And Har HaZeitim is essentially outside the city, right? That's important for us to understand. Okay, so that's just to get us a little bit located. Yes, Suzanne says that the Garden of Gethsemane, I assume you mean over here on this picture. Yeah, this is the Church of All Nations and the Garden of Gethsemane, another place that's very important for Christians, ancient olive trees, right? Olive grove, the belief that this is where Jesus spent his last night before the crucifixion, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, but we're going to start out talking about how the mountain is basically past the border of the city, like we said before, right? So we have, first of all, a few proofs that this is true. Number one, the fact that there are graves in Nahal Kidron, right? At towards the end, we're going to go down virtually to Nahal Kidron, and we're going to see that there are graves there. There are graves there that go back to first temple times. There are monumental graves from second temple times. And of course, we have the cemetery, right? And we'll talk about the cemetery, when that's from. But this idea that there's burial in Nahal Kidron and on Har HaZeitim, that means Jewish burial, that means that we're outside the city, because Jews do not bury inside the city. So that's already a great proof. But in case that's not enough, we also have texts that show us that once you cross over Nahal Kidron, you have left the city, right? So take a look. Let's look at the source on the right here first, the source from Shmuel Bet, right? This is the terrible story of David having to flee from his own son, right? Avshalom rebels against David, and David essentially has to flee for his life, and he goes with his entourage, with all the people who stay loyal to him. And where do they go, right? And take a look. And all the country wept with a loud voice as all the people passed over, and as the king passed over the brook Kidron, Nahal Kidron, all the people passed over toward the way of the wilderness. I'm going to come back to the story in 1 minute, but just another story that very clearly shows that this is the border of the city, right? Long after this story, David comes back. Oh, this should say Kings 1 and not Kings 2. I apologize. David comes back, lives out his days as king, right? And towards the end of his days, he tells his son Shlomo, right, who's going to be the next king. He says, listen, I have some scores that I want you to settle. I want you, some people I want you to reward, some people I want you to punish. One of the people I want you to punish is a guy named Shimi ben Gera from the tribe of Benjamin, who, when David is running away from Absalom, he curses him, and David kind of holds back. He doesn't respond, but he tells Shlomo, you'll know what to do with him. And Shlomo does know what to do with him, and this is what he does, right? Take a look over here on the left. And the king, this is Shlomo, sent and called for Shimei and said to him, build your house in Jerusalem and dwell there, and go not forth any, sorry, this is a very antiquated translation, and go not forth anywhere, right? Do not go anywhere. Do not leave Jerusalem. Now, you're probably, I can imagine Shimei is being called by the king. He knows that David was not exactly owing him any favors. And here's David's son calling him for an audience, and he's probably shaking in his boots. And then all Shlomo says to him is, you're not allowed to leave the city. And he probably like sighs a big sigh of relief. But Shlomo is very smart, because he understands that this is not something that people can do in long term. Eventually he's going to slip up, and that's what he does. And then Shlomo has the right to punish him, i.e. to execute him. But look at how he says to him, how he defines for him leaving the city. For on the day you go out and pass over the brook Kidron, that's leaving. Leaving is passing over Nahal Kidron. So just like we saw with David and Absalom, here too, once Shimei leaves the Kidron Valley, he's left Jerusalem behind. Go back to that David story for a minute, because there's something very significant that happens there. First of all, it's a very terrible story, right? Everybody's leaving and they're crying, right? Take a look at the bottom here of this source. And David went up by the ascent of the Mount of Olives and wept as he went, and he had his head covered and he went barefoot, right? He's in mourning. And all the people that were with him covered his head, and they went weeping as they went, right? They're going into exile. But David does something very important here. So go back to the part we skipped. And Tzadok also came, right? Tzadok is the Kohen, and all the Levites with him, bearing the Ark of the Covenant. Remember, David, when he conquers Yerushalayim, what does he bring to the city? He brings the Aron HaElokim. He brings the Ark, which had been in exile. And now Tzadok says, okay, you have to leave, but we're going to take the Aron with us, right? But what is the king saying? And the king said to Tzadok, carry the Ark back into the city. If I find favor in the eyes of the Lord, he will bring me back and show me it and its habitation. And if he says, I have no delight in you, here I am, let him do to me as seems good unto him. So David says, if God brings me back, wonderful. I'll be in the city and the ark will be in the city. If he doesn't, he doesn't. But the ark has to stay in the city. And by doing that, David ensures that Jerusalem is the last stop, right? Jerusalem, the ark is not going to move anymore. and Jerusalem remains the holy place, and there's no more transition to a different city. So that's just an important point, not necessarily connected to Har HaZeitim. Okay, we'll come back to the significance of Har HaZeitim in a second, but just Susanna asked if the Garden of Gethsemane is in my original picture. This is a picture from the Garden of Gethsemane. This is a beautiful garden at the bottom of Har HaZeitim with these very ancient olive trees. And they're about 1,000 years old, we think, go back to Crusader times, and maybe are even shoots from even older olive trees, right? The people who come to visit the garden really see it as the place that has the original trees from the time of Jesus. And they're beautiful trees, right? As you can see, these really thick trunks, these very, very ancient trees. Olive trees can live a very, very long time. But this is nice to see because it tells us the significance of the name. Har HaZeitim, the Mountain of Olives. It's not named that way just because it's poetic. It's named that way because this is where olive trees were grown. Think about olive trees, very appropriate time of year to think about them. Olive trees are grown here because we are in proximity to the Beit HaMikdash. Why do we need olive trees? Because we need olive oil. Why do we need olive oil? For the menorah, for the Shemen HaMishcha, for the anointing oil, right? Olives are very important in the whole story of the Mikdash and what you use in the Mikdash. And actually, in the church that's right next door to the garden here, it's built on the remains of a Crusader church, which was built on the remains of a Byzantine church. And recently they had to do some repairs and they discovered a mikvah from Second Temple times underneath the Byzantine church. Okay, telling us, why is there a mikvah here? This is not a place where people live. But maybe it's a place where people are making this olive oil in tahara, in purity, because they're making it for the Beit HaMikdash. So Har HaZeitim, like we said, it has a few names. Har HaZeitim and Har HaMishcha. The Mishnah talks about, also the Tanakh talks about Har HaMishcha. Mishcha is in Mashuach, right? Mashiach, the anointed, the anointing oil. So it's the same meaning, right? It's the same meaning here. All of it connected to the olive trees. Okay, what else do we know about Har HaZeitim in Tanakh and in Jewish tradition? So it's not only that it's on the border of the city, but it's also the place where the Shekhinah goes, right? Kivyachol, the Shekhinah leaves the city, leaves Har HaBayit, and goes into exile. Okay, so we have a pasuk in Sefer Yechezkel. Right, and it talks about the Shekhinah, and the glory of the Lord went up from the midst of the city and stood upon the mountain, which is on the east of the city. The Har, like we said, Har, Asher Mikedem La'ir. So what does it mean? It means that, let's just read it in the Hebrew also. I only put in one for a lack of space, but we can read both from the Tanakh, right? Vayal kvod Adonai, right? The glory of God. Me'al toch ha'ir, vayamod al ha'ar asher mikedem la'ir. So in Yechezkel, right, it's talking about Shem's presence going from Har HaBayit to the east. Chazal, the rabbis, pick up on this, and they talk about how the Shekhinah makes journeys as the people are sinning and getting further and further away from God. God is also getting further from them. And we have this in a few sources, one in Eicha Rabba, one in the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah. The Shekhinah made 10 journeys, right? I didn't write for you all the journeys, but basically going from the Kodesh Kodashim and going further and further out from one cherub to the next, meaning up on the ark, from the wall to the city, from the city to the Mount of Olives. That's the end. As is written in Yechezkel 11, what we just read. Rabbi Yochanan said, the Shekhinah sat on the Mount of Olives for 3.5 years in the hopes that Israel would repent, and they did not. Right? This is very sad statement of Rabbi Yochanan, that God is waiting for us. Right? He doesn't leave completely. He's waiting for us on Har HaZeitim. When we don't repent, he moves on. Right? But this idea of the Shekhinah and Har HaZeitim is a very powerful idea. And it sticks around in Jewish thought. And in the Cairo Geniza, we found a letter from the 11th century. that talks about people coming to Har HaZeitim to pray there, right? The 11th century, the Muslims are in control in Jerusalem. They built the Dome of the Rock. They built Al-Aqsa. Jews can't go pray on Har HaBayit, right? So where do they go? Take a look. Since the destruction of the temple, the people of the land of Israel gather on the Mount of Olives on Hoshana Rabbah and encircle it seven times, right? We have this, our tradition of going around the Bima seven times on Hoshana Rabbah with our Hoshanos, right? But that goes back to going around the Mizbeach in the Beit HaMikdash. Here they can't go to the Beit HaMikdash, so they go to Har HaZeitim where they can see the place of the Mikdash, and that's where they do their Hoshanos. The first time they face the temple and they say the Hoshana of Evan Hashtiyah, right? The one that's about the temple, and then they complete the whole order. I heard this from Rabbi Zachariah, who exiled himself to Jerusalem for atonement and heard the prayers that day on the Mount of Olives. So Mount of Olives is outside the city. It's also the place where the Shekhinah goes, and at least according to this source, stays. Okay, doesn't leave, but stays in the city. But it's also the place, right? So here we're talking about kind of the past and the present, but we're also talking about the future, right? And we have this idea that the Geula, the redemption, is going to begin on Har HaZeitim, right? And we have this vision, an apocalyptic vision of the end of days. We have it here in Zechariah, probably with the most detail. We also have it in Sefer Yechezkel. We also have it in Sefer Yoel. That's all similar ideas of this huge kind of an earthquake that's going to happen on Har HaZeitim, and water that's going to come out from Jerusalem out towards the east, toward the Dead Sea, right? So see what it says in Sefer Zechariah. Inei ba yom Hashem ba, right? A day of the Lord comes, when thy spoil shall be divided in the midst of you, for I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, right? It's going to be this terrible, horrible battles. The city shall be taken, right? And all of this pillaging and all of this terrible stuff. Then shall the Lord go forth and fight against those nations, and his feet shall stand, right? God's feet, again, Kivyachol, Zechariah can say it, not me, shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives, again, before Jerusalem on the east, Har Asher Mikedem La'ir. And the Mount of Olives shall cleft in half. It's going to break in half toward the east and towards the west. So there shall be a very great valley. Half of the mountain shall move towards the north and half of it towards the south, right? Imagine kind of like tectonic plates, right? We have the shifting. There's going to be an earthquake and the mountain's going to move partly north, partly south. Everyone's going to run away. It's going to be very terrifying. And then what's going to happen? There'll be a day that's not day and not night. And take a look at verse 8. And it shall come to pass on that day that living water shall go out from Jerusalem toward the eastern sea. What does that mean? Water coming out from Har HaBayit, from Har HaZeitim, going out towards the Dead Sea, right? Healing the Dead Sea. We have this image in Yechezkel as well, that this healing of the Dead Sea, it's a very interesting idea, right? Why does the redemption and the apocalypse happen, begin on Har HaZeitim? Maybe we have this idea that it's between the city and the desert. Maybe we have the idea that Jerusalem has to heal Sodom, right? Jerusalem and Sodom are diametrical opposites. I think we talked about this a little in the first class. So water has to come from Jerusalem, living water, Mayim Chayim, has to go to the Dead Sea, right? To Yam HaMavet and to heal it. Whatever it is, we have this idea of kind of this apocalypse and redemption starting on Har HaZeitim. So Har HaZeitim has to hold a lot of different content, a lot of different ideas, just to bring us into the very recent past. And if we want to talk about the beginnings of redemption, in the Six-Day War, right? On the third day of the Six-Day War, the paratroopers take Jerusalem. Right before they enter, Montagur, the commander, talks to them on the ridge above, right, on Har HaZeitim. You have this amazing picture here. And he says, we occupy the heights overlooking the old city. In a little while, we will enter it, the ancient city of Jerusalem, which for generations we have dreamt of and striven for. We will be the first to enter it. The Jewish nation is awaiting our victory. Israel awaits this historic hour. Be proud. Good luck. Okay, so in modern times as well, this is our Atchalta de Geula. This is our beginning of reclaiming the old city, coming back, entering through the Lion's Gate and going up on Har HaBayit, also starting on Har HaZeitim. Okay, let's go back to a little bit more prosaic things. we have the Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah that talks about how do we know when the new month is starting, right? In the time of the Mishnah, we don't have a fixed calendar, but rather you had witnesses who would come in the time of the Beit HaMikdash. They would come to the Sanhedrin. They would be questioned about the new moon. Witnesses who saw the new moon, the Sanhedrin would question them. When their testimony was accepted, then Sanhedrin would proclaim the new month, but you had to get the message out, right? How do you get the message out to the people in the days before, you know, you have phones and internet and anything else? You light signal fires, right? Now, this is up until the time where we hear about the Kutim, the Samaritans, who would mess it up and would, you know, light fake fires. And that's when you have to send messengers. And that's why in the diaspora, we have 2 days of Yom Tov, but we won't go into that. But the original plan is you send out, you light signal fires. Where's the first fire go? Okay, so we have the testimony on Har HaBayit, on the Temple Mount, but that's not the highest point in Jerusalem. You have to go to the highest point in Jerusalem. Where is that? It's on the highest part of Har HaZeitim, right? Har HaZeitim, Har HaTzofim, which is the same mountain. That's the highest place in Jerusalem. Okay, where is that? That's what this picture is over here on the left. This is called the Church of the Ascension, and this seems to be the highest point. This is the highest point on Har HaZeitim, and this seems to be where they would light the Masuot from. So we have our Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah in the second parak. Where would they light the signal fires? From Har HaMishcha, right, the mountain of oil, to the Sartaba. That's the second picture over here. And from the Sartaba to Grofina, and from Grofina to Chavran, and from Chavran to Beit Baltin, and from Beit Baltin, they continued to signal until the whole diaspora was lit up like a bonfire. So one peak to the next. Just to tell you an interesting story that I heard from the person who did it. Here, Batya, this is for you. Your neighbor, Ira, did this. And after the Six-Day War, right, in the early 70s, when you could go once again to Har HaZeitim, which had been in Jordanian control up until 1967, and you could go out to the Sartaba, which is in the Jordan Valley, there was a group of people who decided that they wanted to check it out, right? If you lit a fire on top of Har HaZeitim, would you really see it on the Sartaba? Which the amazing part about this story is this is in the 70s, before there are cell phones, right? And people just, you know, there's a group that went up on Har HaZeitim, lit a fire. There was a group that went up on the Sartaba and looked. And then they met up later and they told what happened. And indeed, you cannot actually see the fire on Har HaZeitim from the Sartaba. You do not have a direct line of sight. Does this mean that the Mishnah is incorrect? No, what it means is that the Mishnah is incomplete, right? And we have a Tosefta that adds in other mountains. And it's clear that these are just kind of some of the high points, but there clearly were other points in between these where you would have other signifiers. In this case, we think that between Har HaZeitim and the Sartaba, you have a very high mountain called Kubat HaNajma in a place called Kohava Shachar, kind of on the edge of the Judean desert. And that was probably the midpoint. But I just love that they tested it out. So that's just a great story. Okay, let's go into the cemetery for a short time. The cemetery on Har HaZeitim is, first of all, the cemetery is a very old cemetery, but it is not the oldest graves in Jerusalem. Okay, there are much, much, much older graves. First, people start to bury in Nahal Kidron, as we said, right? In the Kidron Valley, down below, we have graves from First Temple times, we have graves from Second Temple times. Then they buried on right outside on the western slope of Nahal Kidron, right by where the Golden Gate by Shar HaRachamim, where today there's a Muslim cemetery. In the time of the Mamluks, 13th century, the Muslims kick out the Jews from that cemetery. They don't want them there, and it becomes a Muslim cemetery. And the Jews then move to the slopes of Har HaZeitim. So the cemetery there, the oldest graves there go back about 600 years, which is pretty significant, but it is not, they're not the oldest graves in Jerusalem. In general, we could do a whole Zoom. We could do like 5 Zooms about the graves on Har HaZeitim. There's tons to talk about there. We're just going to mention a few, but just to understand, there are different sections, right? There are different chalkot. Each section is connected to a different chevra kedisha, a different community, right? Whether it's the, you know, Syrian Jews, the Chalabim in Jerusalem, or the Sephardim, or the Hasidim, right? Different groups. each of these Chevra Kadisha is very fortunately kept very distinct records of where the graves are, which was a very good thing, because between 48 and 67, the Jordanians desecrated a very good part of the cemetery, and a lot of the graves had to be restored. But one section at the top of the hill is called Chelkat Yerushalayim, and that was modern times, right? 20th century, late 19th, early 20th century, where you had people who, for the first time, weren't really part of any community. Okay. They were modern people who did grow up in Jerusalem, didn't have a community. Or today you have people who come from Chutz Laaretz who are buried on Har HaZeitim. Chelkat Yerushalayim is where they're going to be buried usually. So one of them is Henrietta Zold. Right? Henrietta Zold, a woman who needs no introduction. She's one of the last graves here before 1948. She's buried here in the first of Adar Aleph, 1945, Tafshin Hei. Henrietta Zold, of course, the founder of Hadassah. Really just one of the greatest women, right? Such an important personality. 1860 to 1945, her life spans so many major events. Grows up in Baltimore and very involved with helping Jewish immigrants like her parents, and then involved in Jewish studies, works for the Jewish Publication Society, goes to the Jewish Theological Seminary on condition she's let in as a woman, on condition that she won't try to get smicha. At a certain point, she comes on a trip to the land of Israel in the early 20th century. She comes with her mother, and she sees, she's very taken by the land of Israel, but she's very disturbed by the state of healthcare, which is horrible. And she goes home and she founds the Hadassah Women's Organization to create health clinics and eventually hospitals in the land of Israel. And I love this picture of her with her proper little lady's hat, but surrounded by all the architects and the plans for the Hadassah Hospital. And she was a real mover and shaker and did amazing things. Another grave up here is Pinchas Rutenberg. Pinchas Rutenberg was a very unusual and interesting individual. He was born in the Ukraine. He was a revolutionary. He was involved and was kicked out of Russia twice, right? In the revolution early on, right? In the beginning, he's expelled from Russia and he becomes a Zionist and he's involved with Jabotinsky and Trumpeldor, and he goes back to Russia and he's involved in more trouble and he gets kicked out again, and he comes to the land of Israel. He's an engineer. Okay? He studied engineering and hydraulics, and he basically figures out how to use water power to make electricity. And he's the first person to make a power plant in the land of Israel using water power from Naharaim, right? From the Yarmouk River and the Jordan and the Jordan River, and he creates the first electrical power plant. He does all kinds of amazing, amazing things. But as you can see, his grave is very simple, right? Pinchas ben Rav Moshe Rutenberg, and the date of his death, Yudal Tevet, Tav Shebet, 1942. And we have a testimony in the newspaper talking about what his desire was for his grave, right? So here's what he says. Beritzoni leheya seif el ami b'har hazeh tib Yerushalayim. I want to be buried with my people on the Mount of Olives. V'ani mivakeshi yinaten li hakavod li tamen ben shurot ha'amelim hatznu'im, right? He's very much a socialist. I want to be buried with the humble workers. Ani mivakesh la'aroch ha'tavayati lefi masoret Yisrael, b'li zeirim u'b'li hespedim. I want everything done according to Jewish tradition. No wreaths, no eulogies. And then he asks for his nephews to say Kaddish, right? And he tells them he wants them to become educated. And then he says, kol nechasai huavru v'yuavru la'otzar Pinchas Rutenberg u'mukdashim la'noar ha'ivri. All of my possessions are given over to a fund to help the Hebrew youth. Okay, and people can give money for it. Ulam bakashati shalola aroch kol asfei kesef amamiyim lahan sachat shmi. Don't collect any money to memorialize me. Ani mevakesh kmo ken lo likrot rechovot, nechalot, kfarim, umoshavot bishmi. Do not name anything after me. Have you ever heard of a person who doesn't want anything named after him? This is Pinchas Rittenberg, very, very humble. It doesn't quite work. He does have a few things named after him, but not so much. But that was his desire. He said, I just wanted to give to the Zionist enterprise, he wasn't really such a Zionist, but he wanted to help Jews in the land of Israel. And I don't want anything named after me. So that's just rather unusual. Okay, another famous grave, Shai Agnon. Okay, Shai Agnon, so far the only Hebrew writer to get the Nobel Prize for Literature for Hebrew, for writing in Hebrew. He also has interesting thing on his grave, right? It talks about it lists his date of death, Yod Aleph Adar Aleph. So we have a lot of Adars here. Hey, Tafshin Lamed, right? 1970. But his date of birth, Tisha B'Av Taf Resh Mem Chet, 1887. Now, he was not born on Tisha B'Av. Okay, we have the records. He's born around the time of Tisha B'Av, but he was not born on Tisha B'Av. But he was a poet, and he had a sense of poetry, and he wanted to be born on Tisha B'Av. And in his Nobel Prize speech, which is what I put for you here, this is what he says. He connects himself to the destruction of the temple. He's born in Bukach. He's born in Eastern Europe, but he sees himself as somebody who's connected to the temple and to Jerusalem. So he says, as a result of the historic catastrophe in which Titus of Rome destroyed Jerusalem and Israel was exiled from its land, I was born in one of the cities of the exile. Meaning he was born 1800 years after the destruction of the temple, but he sees it as a consequence of the destruction of the temple. But always I regarded myself as one who was born in Jerusalem. In a dream, in a vision of the night, I saw myself standing with my brother Levites in the Holy Temple, singing with them the songs of David, King of Israel, melodies such as no ear has heard since the day our city was destroyed and its people went into exile. I suspect that the angels in charge of the shrine of music, fearful lest I sing in wastefulness what I had sung in my dream, made me forget by day what I had sung at night. For if my brethren, the sons of my people, were to hear, they would be unable to bear their grief over the happiness they have lost. To console me for having prevented me from singing with my mouth, they enable me to compose songs in writing. So Shai Agnon, this beautiful poetic way of seeing why he has this gift of writing, because really he's a Levite and he's supposed to sing in the Mikdash, and this is a compensation. Okay, we'll come back to the cemetery for a few more graves, but we're going to make our way down the hill. And the next stop, adjacent to the cemetery, is a cave that you can go in, and you can see it's a large burial cave, which has 26 kind of burial niches, kuchim, and it's called the Kivrei HaNevi'im, the graves of the prophets, right? And the tradition is that this is graves of prophets from the beginning of the Second Temple period, Haggai and Malachi. It is not. Okay, these are graves that some of them are from Second Temple, but most of them are from Byzantine Christian pilgrims who come to the land of Israel and who die here. At some point in the Middle Ages, the Jews connect this to the prophets and the Christians connected as well. But it really is not connected, but it's still a fascinating place to look at. But it's a nice place to talk for a minute about Haggai. So the prophets Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, we already looked at Zechariah. The three of them live at the very beginning of Second Temple times, meaning they're living as the Jews are coming back in the Persian period, Shivat Zion. This is a very difficult time. There's not a lot of Jews who return. Most Jews stay in Babylonia. They don't have a lot of resources. They start to build the temple, and then they have to stop. The Persians stop them, and then they're allowed to start again, but they're reluctant to use their limited resources to build the temple. And along comes Haggai, and he explains to them that building the temple is going to help them and not hinder them, right? So here he is in the second year of Darius the king, in the sixth month, the first day of the month, right? came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet unto Zerubbabel, and he says, the people say the time has not come that the Lord's house should be built. Lo eit bo eit beit Hashem livnot. Right? And the word of the Lord came saying, is it a time for you yourself to dwell in your houses while this house lies waste? You're worrying so much about yourself, about your making a living, about your food. It's not going to work that way. You have it backwards, right? It says, go up to the hill country, bring wood, build a house, and I will take pleasure in it and I will be glorified. Okay? You look for much and it comes to little. When you bring it home, I did blow upon it. Meaning the little that you have disappears. Why, says the Lord? Because of my house that lies waste, while you run every man for his own house. If you do for me, says God, if you give your resources to build the temple, I'm going to give back to you and you will be able to prosper. That's Haggai's message. It's not an easy message to follow, but that's his message, that eventually, right, he says, the glory of the later house will be greater than the glory of the first house, which is very hard for the people in the beginning of Shivat Zion to believe. Really? Our temple is going to be greater than Solomon's temple? Yes, and it is, but it's a hard message to hear at that time. Okay, back to the cemetery for another few graves. As you continue down the hill, you come to the mass grave, right, the Kever Achim, of the fighters in the Jewish quarter who were killed and buried in the Jewish quarter in 1948, right, in May of 1948. Next to them, he dies many years later, right? He only dies in the 1990s, right? Moshe Rosenbaum in the 2000s, actually. When does he die? Moshe Rosenbaum, Tafshin Samach Vav, 2006. Am I remembering that? Am I doing that correctly? I think I am. Right. So Moshe Rosenbaum was the commander of the city within the walls. He was very, very young, as you can see, right? Tafresh Pei Dalet. He was 24. And he was the commander of the struggle against the Jordanians in 1948. He survived. He was taken prisoner, captured by the Jordanians in the surrender, and taken prisoner to Jordan and brought back. But when he died many years later, he was buried next to those who fell in the Jewish quarter in 1948. The battles in 1948 in the Jewish quarter were some of the worst battles of the entire War of Independence. The Old City is under siege for 6 full months from the beginning of the War of Independence at the end of November 1947 until the surrender May 28, 1948. The last couple of weeks, there are quite a lot of people who are killed and who are buried in the Jewish quarter because they can't be taken out. They remain buried in the Jewish quarter until 1967. And after the Six-Day War, their remains are taken out. They're buried together here on Har HaZeitim, facing towards the Old City, right? Very beautiful view of the Old City, of the place that they tried to defend. One of the people who's not buried here, but did die in the battles of the Jewish quarter, she was wounded and she died a few days after the surrender. And so she's buried on Mount Herzl and not in the Jewish quarter, but her story is a very powerful story, and that's Esther Kahlengold. And Esther Kahlengold was a young British woman. She was in London during World War II, lived through the Blitz as a teenager, and then decided she was going to come to the land of Israel, right? Very much a Zionist, comes to the land of Israel and decides she needs to go and to help in the fight and in the struggle. She gets into the Old City and she's involved in whatever is necessary, right? In fighting, in holding positions, in running messages from one place to another, in helping in the infirmary. She's wounded in the last days before the surrender, and she dies a few days after the surrender. This is a letter that she wrote to her family about a week before she was wounded, and we still have that letter. Her sister married Yehuda Avner. People know who Yehuda Avner was, right? Yehuda Avner was a writer for many prime ministers, very, very eloquent and very interesting person and her sister Mimi married him, and he and also her brother Asher, they're all involved in keeping her memory alive. And this is the letter that she wrote. "Dear Mommy, Daddy, and everyone, I am writing to beg you that whatever may have happened to me, you will make the effort to take it in the spirit I want, and to understand that for myself, I have no regrets. We had a difficult fight, and I have tasted of hell, but it's worthwhile because I am convinced that in the end, we will see a Jewish state and realization of all our longings. Remember, we are soldiers who have the greatest and noblest cause to fight for. God is with us. I am proud and ready to pay the price it may cost us. Please, please do not be sadder than you can help. I have lived my life fully, if briefly, and I think that's the best way here in our own sweet land. I hope you will enjoy from Mimi and Asher the satisfaction that you miss in me. Let it be without regrets. Then I too shall be happy. Remember me only in happiness, Esther." Very powerful story. From there, we go to a couple of graves of people who, the local Amuna group in Hendon is named after Esther Kahlengold. Beautiful. We have a few graves of people who fortunately had much longer lives. We have an area that's called Chalkat HaNevi'im because it's near Kivrei HaNevi'im, but also the people in it are holy like prophets. And you have Rav Kook and his students and his successors. So this is the grave of Rav Kook, as you can see, very visited. But what's unusual about his grave, right? Rav Kook, of course, chief rabbi of Jaffa, and then he becomes the chief rabbi of the whole land of Israel. On his grave here, first of all, he makes Aliyah, very interesting, Kafchet Iyar, right? The 28th of Iyar, which is Yom Yerushalayim, right? Many years later. That's the day that Jerusalem is liberated. But we have three times the word Allah, right? Go up. Allah le'eretz HaKodesh, Kafchet Iyar. Allah Yerushalayim, Gimel Elul, and then Allah HaShamayma, right? He went up to heaven, also Gimel Elul. So that's just a powerful and a beautiful way to write his gravestone. Next to Rav Kook, we have his student, right? His student who follows him as the leader of Merkaz HaRav, and that's Rav David HaKohen, or Rav David Kohen, known as HaNazir. His son was Sha'ar Yashuv Kohen, who was the chief rabbi of Haifa. His daughter was Tzipia Goren. She marries Rav Goren. We'll talk about him in a minute. David Kohen, student of Rav Kook, someone who attempted his whole life to get prophecy. That's why if you look at his gravestone, Mivaser Kol HaNevuah, we're going to come back to him at the very end. We have a beautiful quote from him. And he's a Nazir, as you can see in this picture, right? On the one hand, he's got this like very classic look. He's got the hat, he's got the suit, but he's got this beautiful long hair. And he already, as a young man, took a vow to be a Nazir forever, right? He kept this vow his whole life. And not only did he not drink wine and not cut his hair, he also didn't eat meat. He didn't wear leather shoes. His son, Sha'ar Yashuv, was also brought up as a Nazir, but when he turned 13, he was given the choice. Does he want to continue or not? And he chose not to. But David Cohen stays a Nazir his whole life. And like I said, we'll come back to him at the very end. And one last grave, and that's Rav Goren. Okay, Rav Goren was the Nazir's son-in-law. Rav Goren, of course, is famous for many other things besides being the Nazir's son-in-law. He's the first chief rabbi of Tzahal. He's the reason that the IDF has so many things that are meant to make it a Jewish army, ranging from the fact that the food has to be kosher to he was a halachic genius, and he had to deal with many, many halachic issues for soldiers, for burial, for graves. You could see Meshiv, Milchama, Safra, Vesaifa. He was a warrior and a scholar. Just to give you one example, in the War of Independence, there were many Jews who were killed and whose bodies were behind enemy lines. And he went on an amazing, incredible mission where he was able to get permission from Jordan and from Egypt to go behind enemy lines in 1948 and to bring bodies back for burial. Those are the first bodies that are buried on Mount Herzl. And of course, Rav Goren, the iconic picture of him on Har HaBayit, on the Temple Mount. Six-Day War, right? We saw the picture of Mota Gur and the soldiers before. This is the culmination of that story, blowing the shofar, saying Shecheyanu, and saying Kaddish on the Temple Mount in 1967. Okay, that's it for the graves for now. But like I said, there's many more that we could talk about, but we are going to move down the hill, okay, to a relatively modern church called Dominus Flevit, which means the Lord wept. It's a modern church, but it's built on the remains of a much older church, a Byzantine church. And we're going to see that that's built on the remains of a very old burial cave. We'll come to that in a minute. But what's important for us to understand is that this site, if you come into the courtyard of this church, you have an unbelievable view of the Temple Mount. This is the view you get from the courtyard. So big deal, right? If anyone has ever been on Har HaZeitim knows all the way down, you have unbelievable views. But here you have a view where you really have a perfect line of sight into the entrance to the Beit HaMikdash, right? Today it's the Dome of the Rock, but we know the Dome of the Rock is situated in the same place where the Kodesh Kodeshim is. We know that when the Kohanim would prepare the Parah Adumah, the red heifer, they wouldn't prepare it on Har HaBayit. You had to prepare it somewhere else because it makes the impure pure, but it makes the pure impure. So you can't do it on Har HaBayit. But they would have to do it on Har HaZeitim with a line of sight into the Kodesh Kodeshim. And we are pretty sure that this is the place where that happened, that the Parah Adumah was prepared. And that's what we hear about in the Mishnah in Midot, in the Mishnah in Parah. All the walls around the temple compound were high except for the eastern one, because the priest who burnt the red heifer stood on the Mount of Olives and he had to see the doorway of the temple when he sprinkled the blood. Okay, and here we have this picture made by Machon HaMikdash, by the Temple Institute, illustrating the Mishnah that we have in Masechet Parah. They made a ramp from the Temple Mount to the Mount of Olives, arches upon arches to guard against graves, right? The cow, the calf is brought out to Har HaZeitim, but you don't want to become impure from the graves down the valley. So they would make these kind of like barriers against impurity, and the heifer and all those who prepare it go out to the Mount of Olives. So is this the place where they would prepare the Parah Adumah? Very good chance. It's also very likely that this is also the place called Beit HaSrifah, where you would take parts of the sacrifices that were not put on the altar and were taken out to be burnt. Seems like this is also the place where that happens. And on Yom Kippur, right, we have that very important moment on Yom Kippur where you have the lottery of the two goats, and the Seir Lazazel is also taken out over the Kidron Valley, out to the Mount of Olives, and then out to the desert. And again, in Yoma, they made a ramp because of the Babylonians who would pull at the scapegoat's hair and say, take our sins and get out, right? The Babylonians would take this idea very literally that the goat is carrying our sins, right? So they would yell at it and push it, and we didn't like that happening, so they made a ramp. Where is this ramp today, right? Whether it's this ramp or the ramp of the Seir Lazazel, that's a very good question. We have not found any archaeological evidence of it. Presumably it sunk down into the Kidron Valley at some point, but we do not have any evidence of it anymore. But it seems likely that this is the place where those events are happening. Also in the area of the church, right outside the courtyard of the church, there's a burial cave, and the burial cave has in it many ossuaries, right? What are ossuaries? Ossuaries are bone boxes, right? There are over 120 of them. This is how people buried, Jews buried in Second Temple times. They would lay the body out, let it decompose, and then take the bones and put them into these boxes. If you go there, you'll see a sign that tells you that this is an acropolis of Jewish Christians. Why? Because a couple of the ossuaries have a symbol on them, Greek letters that say Christ, but most of them don't. And it's very likely that this was just a Jewish burial cave from Second Temple times that had a few people who did identify themselves as Jewish believers in Jesus. But it's interesting to know that this is a place of burial even long before we have the graves on the Mount of Olives. Okay, we're heading further down the hill. And just to understand where we came from and where we are going, Okay, so we started up here at the very top with this amazing view, and we made our way down. We came down towards Dominus Levitt, and now we're coming further down the hill, right? Passing by that Olive Garden that we talked about, and now we're down in the Kidron Valley. Okay, and down in the Kidron Valley, you have these amazing monumental graves, right? The most famous one being this one, Yad Avshalom, but you have a couple others, Kever B'nai Chazir, Kever Zichariah, right? These really incredible monumental graves down in the bottom of the valley. Whose are they? When are they from? Right? What's our story here? So just to understand again, the valley is the place of burial. If you continue along the valley, right, you could continue walking here along the valley, you'd eventually get to the city of David. But above, there are burial caves. Once you get past the cemetery, there are burial caves, and those are burial caves that go back to First Temple times. These graves here, these are Second Temple graves. Okay, now, yes, Yad Avshalom seems to be a memorial for Avshalom. Avshalom, King David's son, right? First Temple times. We have a pasuk that says Avshalom in his lifetime took and reared up for himself the pillar, which is in the king's valley, for he said, I have no son to keep my name in remembrance. And he called the pillar after his own name, and it is called Avshalom's monument, right? Yad Avshalom unto this day, right? Which is it's a very strange pasuk, because we know that Avshalom actually does have children. So what does it mean he doesn't have children? Right, we're not going to go into that. That's a good question for Bible scholars, for commentaries, right? But what does he do? He makes himself a yad, right? Let's just read the words in Hebrew. This is your science, sorry. Yudchet. Right, he makes a monument, right? A yad is not a hand. A yad is a memorial. I mean, it is a hand, but it also means a memorial, like Yad Vashem. Okay. And here you have this memorial down in the valley. It seems that at the top of this little spitzy thing, this little pointy thing, there was a hand at some point, which broke off, and this became known as Avshalom's monument. Is it Avshalom's monument? It most certainly is not. Okay, the style is Second Temple. In fact, anyone who's been to Petra, this may remind you of Petra, or if you've been to Herodian, or if you're coming on the trip next week, we're going to go to Herodian and talk about Herod's grave. Okay. This is the style of Herod's grave as well. This is a Second Temple, late Second Temple style. But the traditional view of the people of Jerusalem was that this is Avshalom's grave. And in fact, we have stories that the people of Jerusalem, if you had a child that wasn't behaving quite properly, you would take him down to the Kidron Valley to Yad Avshalom, who's the ultimate, disobedient son is Avshalom. Take him down there, read him the verses in Sefer Devarim about the Ben Sorer Umoreh, the rebellious son. And then you would take stones. You wouldn't stone the child. This is all as a warning, but you'd throw stones at the base of the monument. Now, people told the story. It sounded like an old wives' tale, but in the 70s, when they excavated these graves, they actually found a huge pile of stones at the base of this monument. So that's just kind of neat that people actually did do this, but it is not Avshalom's grave. As you continue along the valley, you come to two other graves, right? One is called Kever B'nai Chazir. That's this one with the pillars. And the other one is called Kever Zichariah. Okay, Kever B'nai Chazir, why do we call it that? Because it's actually an inscription that was discovered on top of the monument. And it says, Zeh Kever V'haNefesh. This is the monument, and the Nefesh is like the top part of the monument that's meant to symbolize the soul going up to God. Shel Elazar, Chonyo, Yoazer, Yoezer, Yehuda, Shimon, Yochanan, right? All of this, a family grave. Bnei Yosef, Ben Oved Yosef, Be'elazar, Bnei Chonyo, Kohanim, Mi Bnei Chazir. Bnei Chazir, one of the families of the Kohanim who serve in the temple. And these guys are part of that family, and they were probably very wealthy, and that's why they get buried down here. So these are the B'nai Chazir. Zechariah, we talked about Zechariah at the beginning of the class. This is a different Zechariah, okay? We hear about Zechariah in Sefer Yirmiyahu. He's a prophet who is killed, and we have this Gemara in Gittin that talks about how Nebuchadnezzar's general comes, and he sees that there's blood boiling up from the floor of the Temple Mount, and he says, "Whose blood is it? What? Why is this blood boiling?" And he gives sacrifices, and then he kills people. He kills the rabbis. He kills the children. And this is all because Zechariah was killed by the people for being a prophet, saying things they didn't like. And this is just an example of the punishments the people got for doing that. And finally, even Nebuzaradan, even this Babylonian general, has enough. He says, "Zechariah, Zechariah, I have slain the best of them. Do you want me to destroy them all?" And when he said this to him, it stopped, right? The blood stopped bubbling again. Very powerful story, not a first temple period grave, but a good story nonetheless. Okay, our last grave that we're going to look at down in the valley is the grave of somebody much more recent. This is Rabbi Ovadia of Bartanura. Bartanura, not the wine, the place, right? Rabbi Ovadia is an Italian rabbi, and he writes very famous commentary on the Mishnah. And he comes at the end of his life to Jerusalem to live out his days in Jerusalem, and he's buried down in the Kidron Valley. And this is a letter that he writes home. And he says, "I have taken a house here close to the synagogue. The upper chamber of my dwelling is even in the wall of the synagogue. In the court where my house is, there are five inhabitants, all of them women," right? Which is not so unusual. A lot of people would come to Jerusalem basically to like live out their days and be buried in Jerusalem. Women tended to live longer than men. And so there were widows, but the men were all gone. "There's only one blind man living here, and his wife attends on me. Most of those who come to Jerusalem from foreign countries fall ill, owing to climatic changes and the sudden variations of the wind, now cold, now warm. All possible winds blow in Jerusalem. It is said that every wind before going where it lists comes to Jerusalem to prostrate itself before the Lord." And if you've been in Jerusalem in the winter, you know that blessed be he that knows the truth. Okay, our final source that we're going to look at is the Nazir. Back to the Nazir. Hey, the Nazir was always on a quest to receive prophecy. And he would do all kinds of things. He would listen to music. He would try to put himself in a state to receive prophecy. And he would sometimes go down to the Kidron Valley to Yad Avshalom. And this is from the Nazir's diary. Hey, and he talks about a visit that he made to Yad Avshalom, right? "Mi Yomanei HaNazir Rav David Kohen," from the diary of the Nazir. "Halachti lashiv ruchi misaviv le'ir HaKodesh al haharim haKedoshim misaviv li b'chai ruchi." I went to restore myself and the mountains around the holy city, and my soul came back to itself b'mar nafshi mod, when I was very upset. "Yashavti mimul Yad Avshalom," I sat opposite Yad Avshalom, "v'hotzeti tanach shel kis sheli v'karati," and I took out a small tanach and I read, "Ruchi chai v'nafshi itpashta v'chol hamar'eh ha'ne'edar ha'mistarei ha'shamay." My soul came back to life and was filled with, my soul was filled with the incredible view that I saw there. "B'shvilei ha'nevi'im shedarchu shama," in the paths of the prophets who walked there. "V'ruchi b'tikva v'tochel b'tzipia v'nubo'a shetitgale," and I was filled with the hope and the yearning that prophecy will be revealed. "U'bilibi gam tzipia yeshiva ha'gdola," I also had hopes for the great yeshiva, which is Merkaz HaRav, right? Rav Kook's yeshiva. "Beit ha'midrash sheyibaneh sham," that will build our yeshiva there in Nachal Kidron. "Shzei yamim achadim arachti tochnit la," I made plans for it. "U'kratia l'maran ha'rav shlita," I called it in the memory of Rav Kook. "V'shava shabah hamila achronat chiyat ruach hanivuah," that we're going to bring the spirit of prophecy back. Okay, so this is the view that we see from the top looking down. And Har HaZeitim, you really have to be there in order to really understand it, but I hope we got a little bit of a taste of it just from the pictures. So hold on, there were a question or two that I wasn't paying attention to, so let's see. Yehuda Avner was from Irene's area. Very cool. Became Israeli ambassador to the UK eventually, yes. Isn't it interesting? The picture of Rav Goren is less widespread than the picture of the three individual soldiers. Yes, that's true. That became the iconic picture. Yes, I don't know. There's something to the picture. Okay, everybody, this is our last class until we do another series. At the moment, we don't have another series planned, but thank you everybody for joining. Happy Hanukkah, and we'll see about classes. At the moment, the next few months are busy with actual tourists, but hopefully we will be able to do another class maybe later on in the winter. And anyone who's here, please come join next week. Chanukah Sameach, Shabbat Shalom, and thank you, everybody. Thank you. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you so much. Wonderful.
Thank you.
As usual, great.
Very interesting. Always. Thank you. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.